With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk, TNT.
Hello and welcome, my friends, to another day at the Johnny Vedmore Show on today's News Talk, TNT. And it has been a beautiful day. I may look a little brown because it's been a beautiful day outside. I mean, completely and utterly gorgeous. It feels like they're going to allow us to have some summer early, and then they will form the clouds above us and make everything miserable for proper summer. But until then, I'm going to enjoy it. I'm sure you are too. I see people already in the chat. I've already been having a little chat with everybody, like I like to do at the start of a show. So welcome to a new day. Now, I have been a journalist for a while now, and when I started off, it was hard to understand my place. I could have written about absolutely anything whatsoever, but I ended up doing what felt natural, which was following family trees and looking at legacy. I really enjoyed that, and it was the best place to start off for me. I discovered lots of very interesting information from digging around in the past. You always do. It's the past is just it gives us a look into our own present and our future, of course. First, I uncovered previously unreported facts about Laura Koonsberg's family, and I thought that was the best I'd be able to do. I was like, wow, that's amazing. I'm a journalist. I've done my work. Now I'm going to go. Why would I be someone who discovered interesting information about a famous person? Why would I be the discoverer of that information? That's what I always thought. Surely one of these professional journalists out there would have got there first if it was worth reporting. And I kind of had that mindset when I started being a journalist. Secondly, I revealed Theresa May's father had worked with an infamous serial killer and that the case had been covered up. And the murderer, Dr. John Bodkin Adams, got away with killing over 130 people. Surely, though, one of these professional journalists would have got there first if it was worth reporting. Well, 250,000 people who read that article in the first week seemed to disagree. Then I started to realize that something was amiss. It took me a while to get to the real meat. It was the Epstein case where I first started making an impact, which garnered a response from the subject of my investigation. Previously, these elites had simply ignored me. But once I reported on Nicole Yunkerman, I suddenly had microtaskers employed to delete me from the internet. I had legal teams censoring my content, and I had an intelligence asset focused on hiding my journalism, which was very interesting. But I continued onwards, and after a year I started my Schwab series, and I realized that the idea that one of these professional journalists would have got there first if it was worth reporting wasn't actually a thing. Those reporters were professionals, so professional in fact that they were seemingly paid to look the other way. And I kept diving into history, diving down loads of different rabbit holes, and I got pretty fearless. But with that fearlessness came a little naivety. I had experienced censorship, so what's the worst any of these intel assets could do? In actual fact, they could do a lot. They could infiltrate every bit of my life. They could use everyone I cared about to stop me writing. Although I didn't stop, soon large parts of my life were no longer normal. I'd have regular encounters with people who I'd find out later were working either for intelligence or via conduits, and I discovered that I was being managed at times, of course. That's what happens in this trade, I'm afraid. I didn't stop, however much my life fell apart and however much they took from me, I kept going forward. Throughout that time, I have felt like I'm on a mission. And the deeper I dig, the more I'm able to define reality, not only for other people, for myself too, because it's what we do in life. We go around trying to work out what our reality is. And within no time whatsoever, I was being smeared by almost everyone who I thought was on my side. I discovered that a cage was being constructed around me and actors were placed in significant parts of my life. It was only a matter of time before my private life became public. I knew this for years beforehand. I knew it would happen because it's the only tool intelligence has to crush you once everything else has fallen to the wayside. It was made clear to me on a number of occasions that if I continued down the path that I was on, they would take almost everything from me. And that loss occurred. It wasn't a surprise, but the experience was totally harrowing. To be smeared publicly is an extremely interesting experience to go through. You soon discover who your real friends are, and you also understand your enemies too. But regardless, I'm here. I have learned to grow a thick skin. I have learned to be like water, as Bruce Lee would say. I have cried a million tears, all made up of water, and I have moved on. No matter what they throw at me, I will continue. I only have one life, and the worst they can do is take it away from me. And now I know the dance. It is a contrived two-step where one foot is always aflame while the other sits within reality. Now, my people, don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT app from either Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download. Keep you up to speed on TNT.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I've been in the car all day and I got to listen.
Can't get enough of it.
You guys are doing a great job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, people, a U.S. Senate report released Monday has revealed that multiple major automakers relied on forced labor in China for some purchased parts. Here with the story, joining me now is TNT News producer Adam Clark, a.k.a. Ruckus, our own forced laborer. How are you today?
That's not true. Let's correct the record. I am not forced labor. So we talk quite frequently on these programs, on this media journey that we're all on here, yourself included, speaking to the audience members. We talked about, you know, things like big banksters. We've talked about big pharma. We've talked about big agriculture. Now we're going to talk about big auto. Biggest ones. Let's focus specifically on BMW, Jaguar, Land Rover, and Volkswagen AG. They have all apparently purchased parts from a Chinese supplier who has been sanctioned for using forced labor. This is what a report detailing findings of a probe by the U.S. Senate does indeed suggest. This probe was launched by the Senate Finance Committee 2 years ago. It discovered that some of these parts have been used in vehicles imported to the United States, even after automakers assured the committee that they have, quote, robust compliance programs, end quote, to prevent components made with forced labor from entering their supply chains. So what on earth? How did this happen? According to the report released on Monday, the three automakers brought LAN, LAN transformers, a module that connects a vehicle's electronics, manufactured by Sichuan Jingweidi Technology Group, JWD. This is a Chinese company flagged for relying on the forced labor of Uyghur Muslims in China's far western region of Xinjiang. Those parts in question, according to the 108-page report, were sourced via California-based Borns Inc., B-O-U-R-N-S, which in turn provided them to Michigan-based Lear Corp., who is a direct supplier for BMW and Jaguar Land Rover, JLR. In January, Borns notified Lear that those LAN transformers were produced by JWD and thus prohibited in vehicles being shipped to the United States. On January 11th, Lear informed BMW, JLR, Volvo, and Volkswagen of the banned components. Despite that notification in April of 2024, after the Senate committee explicitly asked whether they ever, quote, directly or indirectly sourced parts from JWD, end quote, Jaguar, JLR, claimed to be unaware of its links to the sanctioned manufacturer, and BMW told the committee that JWD was not in its quote-unquote supplier list. Let's see, furthermore, the report reads that, quote, in fact, BMW continued to import products manufactured by JWD until at least April 2024 and appears to have stopped only after the committee repeatedly asked detailed questions to Lear and Lear's OEM customers, including BMW, about their relationship with JWD. BMW has informed the committee that it voluntarily disclosed to CBP that shipments of vehicles and spare parts that entered the U.S. market after December 11th, 2023, included a land transformer produced by JWD, end quote. So check this out. Following repeated questions from the committee, quote, BMW disclosed that at least 8,000 Mini Cooper cars containing JWD components had been shipped to the United States, end quote. In January, Volkswagen voluntarily disclosed to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, that a shipment of their automobiles destined for the United States contained a JWB-made part. The company subsequently replaced the parts before the cars entered the country. I think you get the point. So all of this is all, the argument is about whether or not we should be having the cars imported and on the roads here in the United States. And as with most things, Johnny, the actual real life argument that needs to be discussed is being ignored. We have people being forced into labor, the Uyghur Muslims in China. This is an ongoing issue, and it seems to never, ever, ever get addressed properly. But what say you, my friend?
Yeah, it's one of those issues that is hard to report on, even because if you anything you see out of there is manipulated heavily by propaganda. So there's definitely the Uyghur Muslims who are being interned for years now. It's been a long time that they've been interned, retrained, reprogrammed, you could say, and put into work across the country. Now, in a sense, if you go 10 years before, that's what they were doing to regular Chinese people as well. They were picking up the Chinese farmers. They were beating them around the legs if they refused. Get in the van, stick you in your 15-minute city or your mega city, and there's your new life. Now you're going to be working for us, whether you like it or not. And the future, however much we try and deny it, the future is forced labor. It's forced labor for us, and it's forced labor for them. It's not even you don't even have to be a Uyghur to be forced to work for these big companies eventually. And you see that within the documentation of the World Economic Forum and the training slides, where they want to go in the future. They want you to own nothing and be happy. They want to pay you in CBDCs that have expiry dates. They want to force you to do work with pittance in return. I don't see how that isn't forced labor either. So we're all going to get forced labor, but China is the model that they're going to better. This is how I've always described globalism and the way Kissinger saw globalism and what they started to create in the 60s and 70s. What they started to see is that countries like China would show us the way our future will be, and they'll help them create it, and then they'll do it better in the West, and that's the way they'll maintain their power, is by using China as a model. So China has to work faster than the West. It has to work quicker than the West. It has to cut all laws and cut all regulations so it can make sure it can pick up anybody from the street and throw them in a factory and start creating that future. But everything they're creating and that whole infrastructure will collapse as well soon, because I mean, you've got artificial intelligence around the corner and machines which will do nearly all of these jobs, and all of these people, all of these forced laborers will suddenly have nothing to do. I can't see that being the case. I'm not sure what comes after then, but I think people have a lot of guesses, and most of them are Club of Rome style nefarious solutions to the human problem and the human condition. So it's really strange. And we heard it from the sanctions put on certain cars happening across America. They're trying to limit keep limiting the Chinese expansion. Yet at the same time, we're seeing, you know, we see the slippage. This is slippage. This is all they've been found that these parts were made by forced labor, and we promised we wouldn't use any of them. But it's just slippage. This is all the same society being created, and it's all working at different speeds. So forced labor for them now, that will be the norm for us in the future. It won't be called forced labor. The World Economic Forum training slideshow, that sort of thing, they redefine everything. One of my favorite ones was climate change. In 2011, they have this slide, you know, it's already been global warming, is climate change. They've got this big training slide, and right at the top where it says climate change, it says, should we rebrand it? Should we call it something different? Because that's what they do. They're just going to call forced labor something different eventually. What do you think will actually happen about this? This report, this Senate report has been released. Is there actually going to be sanctions put on? Are there going to be fines attached? Or is it just that they're saying, oh, look, this has happened and it won't happen again?
Yeah, it's just the findings of a report. All of these Senate committees lead pretty much nowhere. It's 2 years worth of an investigation, a waste of time, a waste of taxpayer dollars, all to basically slap the wrist of a selected few, because I guarantee this is going on with other big automakers too. We're not hearing about them because they probably greased some palms along the way, Johnny. So I'm guessing that maybe at some point, somewhere, somebody in the hierarchy at BMW, Jaguar, Land Rover, or Volkswagen pissed somebody off or didn't want to play, or somebody's getting punished. I don't know. Nothing in my report says what they're going to do about this. But if they do, it's probably just going to be fines. Say, hey, how dare you? You need to try better next time. And then again, at the end of the day, nothing is being addressed about the human rights violations taking place in Xinjiang, if that is indeed what is taking place. But I want to remind folks, because, I mean, genocide is a word that we're hearing a lot of lately. But before the stuff with Israel and Palestine and Gaza, we heard genocide being talked about by the U.S. government, by both the Trump and the Biden administrations, because they have described the human rights violations in Xinjiang as genocide. So, yeah. But again, you know, nothing happens. Genocide continues. Johnny.
Yeah, it'll all continue. Village Farmer in the chat, just looking across at what people are saying in chat, said these idiots won't last long trying to use technology to run humanity. It will be similar outcome to COVID. I think a lot of people feel like that, you know. And Teresa Wild says work will set you free. That's a good way to leave it, I think. Thank you, Ruckus. Join us again in the second hour. I look forward to it.
Oh, I'll be there.
I bet you will. You're listening to today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's State of the Nation.
And people think that 137 voters might not be that big a deal, but remember, that's only against the Bureau of Motor Vehicles database. So Secretary of State LaRose has asked the Biden administration for access to federal databases, and those are scheduled to be released to the Ohio Secretary of State's office on the 12th of November.
Good. Well, okay. A little late in the game there. Why is that not publicly available, or at least available to, you know, official auditors, you know, something like that? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Come on, man. There's an election to steal.
Come on, man. Yes, of course.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are opportunity zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Johnny Vedmore Show on today's News Talk TNT. My first guest up today is an amazing researcher and author, and I definitely consider him a friend too. Richard Poe is a New York Times best-selling author and award-winning journalist. He has written widely on business, science, history, and politics. Poe's books include The Shadow Party, co-written with David Horowitz, The Einstein Factor, co-written with Wing Wenger, Perfect Fear, Four Tales of Terror, Black Spark, White Fire, the Wave series of network marketing books, and many more. Poe was formerly editor of David Horowitz's frontpagemag.com, contributing editor to newsmax.com, senior editor of Success Magazine, reporter for the New York Post, and managing editor of the East Village Eye. You can follow him on X at Real Richard Poe, and I can tell you he is the real Richard Poe, and visit his website at richardpoe.com. Mr. Poe, I'm so delighted to have you on the show today. The last time we spoke properly was actually on Halloween. And since then, you've been very busy. How have you been?
Well, I've been great. And of course, I have been busy. My book just came out a few days ago. And my latest book, you named so many of the others. I don't usually get that treatment. It was like... Yes, I've written quite a few books in the past, but my latest, shall I say the name of it?
Well, I can start off by saying, so to begin with, please tell my audience how the British invented communism and blamed it on the Jews.
Yes. Basically what I allege in this book is that... the British, for more than 200 years, have been pioneering the field of what we now call color revolutions, the strategy or the science, if you will, of overthrowing foreign governments and making it look as if it's a spontaneous uprising of the people. And I present evidence that this was done to King Louis XVI of France in 1789, that the French Revolution actually was a British-sponsored color revolution, and also the Russian Revolution of 1917, and the Bolshevik Revolution in particular, and that communism as we know it today, I argue, was developed by these specialists within the British secret services who were engaged in this business of color revolution, that communism was basically a kind of a formula that was adopted from the early English socialists, people who were sincerely socialist or communist, if we want to use the word sincerely, but then was weaponized and adapted for the use of the secret services for the purpose of overthrowing governments. And I argue further that Karl Marx himself was arguably a British agent. Certainly at certain times of his life, he was indisputably and explicitly an agent of influence for British imperial interests. And I think he was pretty much his whole life. He was in fact married into the high nobility of Scotland. He married a woman whose father was a Prussian baron and his mother was a Scottish noblewoman who descended from the Earls of Argyll. A little known fact about Marx, he actually married into the high nobility of Scotland and arguably into royalty.
Yeah, that's amazing. You did what you just stated there makes so much sense, because suddenly I did a lot of, I've done so much research on the color revolutions. I wrote an article called the Non-Governmental Octopus, which led on from doing research on the CIA, the German Marshall Fund, and a creation basically of what the Germans paid the Americans to start helping with these color revolutions. But a lot of the people involved in these color revolutions were NGOs that were run by or headed up by people like Soros, of course, who we'll talk about a little bit later. So it makes so much sense to go back into history and check for that pattern of occurring before. It's actually something we were talking about in the chat just before we started the show, which was about, you know, the plandemics and stuff. Well, you go back 100 years, you got the Spanish flu, and that seemed contrived and seemed like a bit of an operation. But if you go back 8-9 years before, you've got the elements of the operation happening right in front of us. So what evidence is it that is, I mean, extra interesting about Karl Marx? That's something that I'm really interested in, because I do find the British links with Marx extremely interesting. Why do you think he was welcomed in so much by the British? Is it because they knew that he was creating one of the, or was it them who was behind the creation of communism, really?
Well, the first reason he was welcomed to England is that England was considered to be the mecca of revolutionaries, and the conventional explanation for this in history books is because of the tradition of English liberty, supposedly somehow just intrinsically England was more open-minded and freer and all that, and so revolutionaries from all over Europe and later all over the world would come there and find a safe haven. I take a more cynical position on this. I think that the British government actually wanted these revolutionaries to come there so they could be recruited, trained, brainwashed, if you will, and used, you know, those who were found to be recruitable. And most people are recruitable when you get right down to it, in one way or the other, money, blackmail, it's the oldest story in the world. And there's nothing like a threadbare revolutionary, especially a sincere one, to present such a pathetic and helpless figure as to be easily recruited by intelligence professionals. So England opened its doors to these people from quite early on and basically invited them all to come there. And Marx, like all the rest of them, he'd been kicked out of a number of countries in Europe, came to England. That was the haven. And there was a whole movement that was based out of London of German-speaking communists and socialists and German Jews in particular. Who were communists and socialists. Now, you asked, did the British invent the very concept of socialism? Well, no, of course not. That's a little poetic license, if you will, in my title. In the book of Acts in the New Testament, of course, the early Christians owned everything in common. And in fact, many of the early socialists in England, and England was an early wellspring of socialist ideas, and many of them, if not most, were Christian utopians to begin with. But quite early on, there were a number of socialists who they're called Ricardian socialists because they were kind of an outgrowth of the English political economy of Adam Smith and Ricardo, and in particular Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages, which basically said that in the real world, no capitalist is going to pay his workers more than it takes to keep them alive and keep them breeding the next generation of workers. And this came to be known as his Iron Law. And so a whole generation of they're called the early English socialists. They latched onto this and said, well, look, here is one of the greatest apologists for capitalism. And he's admitting that it's an iron law of capitalism that the workers will always be kept in subjection. So many of these, and the one who's most interesting is a guy named Charles Hall. He wrote a book in 1805, whose name I forgot. But the interesting thing about Hall is that he put forth many of the what Marx and Engels later came to call the scientific aspects of their socialism. Marx and Engels wrote explicitly about these early English socialists and very dismissively that they were, yeah, their hearts were in the right place, but they were basically moralists, or they thought capitalism was bad, but they didn't know why. I discovered an academic paper from 1983. It was written by someone named J.E. King, and I think it was called Utopia or Science or something like that. But basically in this paper, King argues very convincingly that these early English socialists, especially Charles Hall, really were the precursors of Marxism and had put forth many of the aspects of Marxism that Engels especially considered to be unique to Marx's works. And so he was, in a sense, unfair to the others.
Yep. That's listen, we're going to take a quick break for the news, but I have so many questions after taking in what you just said there. We are all listening to today's news talk on TNT.
Turn on the news!
News flash.
TNT Radio
for
News.
TNT, this is James O'Neill. The National Rifle Association elected former U.S. Congressman Bob Barr as president and Doug Hamlin as executive vice president and CEO during their board meeting on May 20th, following the NRA's 153rd annual meetings and exhibits in Dallas, Texas. During former President Donald Trump's trial in New York City, Michael Cohen, a former associate and lawyer for Trump, admitted to stealing thousands of dollars from the Trump Organization.
The common housefly. Caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Johnny Vedmore Show. It's me, Johnny Vedmore, and I'm talking with Richard Poe. Richard, you were talking about this what is a maelstrom of ideological thinking happening during this certain period that kind of like ends up forming into the communism that we see today through someone like Karl Marx. Now, was this all really from British and American institutions like educational establishments, universities? Is this where all of this thought process was happening, or was it wider? Was it all across Europe, or why did people tend to come to Britain? Were British universities freer thinking places back in that time?
Well, they were freer, and of course. Because of the Industrial Revolution, the ideas of socialism and communism were springing up simply in reaction to the horrific working conditions and the new situation, the creation of an industrial proletariat, and so forth. So these movements were springing up in many places in Europe, but they were suppressed very harshly in most places. And so many of these revolutionaries, like Marx, ended up in England. Yes, it was freer there, but it is my argument in my book that the British intelligence, the British secret services, also benefited from this situation. They wanted those revolutionaries there so they could guide them mold them, recruit them, and use them for what we now call color revolutions, sending them back into these their countries of origin and using them to win converts and to be a front for regime change operations, which in fact were instigated by the British. And in order to make them effective for this purpose, what happened is that their ideologies were weaponized. They were sharpened into weapons. And so, for example, before the break, we were talking about the early English socialists, and many of whom were Christian utopians, and many of whom were onto some of the same economic critiques of capitalism and its unfairness, as Marx later became famous for pointing out. But I think they were rejected by the organs of state intelligence, if we could use a Soviet-like word such as that, because they were too sincere, they were too soft, and they were too humane. And so what was created instead in the form of Marxism and later Marxism-Leninism is something that was much less humane, that was much more sharp-edged, much more potentially violent. And we see this pattern of a push toward violence. And we going back to the French Revolution, we see this trend whenever there is a pressure on, let's say, revolutionary forces to move towards violence, to move towards blood purges and executing kings and things like that. We see the hidden hand of British intelligence at work. And this was alleged first in the French Revolution by no less than Thomas Jefferson, who was the American ambassador to France after the revolution. He was the first U.S. ambassador to France once we won independence. And he and the Marquis de Lafayette actually favored the revolution at first, the French Revolution when it first broke out. They hoped it would lead to a more constitutional sort of monarchy in France. And they were both horrified, apparently, when the revolution was seemingly taken over by violent and seemingly irrational elements. And we ended up with the Reign of Terror. And Thomas Jefferson, in later correspondence with Lafayette, referred clearly, and apparently they both agreed with this. He blamed the British, and he blamed the British secret services, who he claimed in his letters were going into France and bribing people and getting them to embrace this more violent program. And in his opinion, it was this British interference which destroyed the revolution, which he and Lafayette had originally favored, and which eventually resulted in the execution of the king and queen. So Jefferson himself alleges that, apparently from knowledge, since he was the U.S. ambassador in Paris at the time the revolution broke out, and even had some dealings with the revolutionaries, which might even be called questionable. He was a bit of an instigator in that at first.
With relation to these revolutions and how this progressed, was this all of this necessity to create ideology, necessity to be in control, did it really stem from the moment that the Oliver Cromwell and the parliamentarian forces chopped off King Charles's head?
I think it did, actually. In many ways, it began with the English Civil War. And in fact, America already existed as a fairly well-developed colony at that time. And it's one of the untold stories of the English Civil War that the colonies here were very much divided along the same lines. And it could be argued that our own revolution, the American Revolution, was a continuation of the English Civil War, where the puritanical, commercial, bourgeois forces rose up and created their own nation. in the United States. That's one way of looking at it. But absolutely, it that this revolutionary impulse does seem to have begun in England during the 17th century. And in fact, in the French Revolution, the front organization that was actually the most important interface for British intelligence with the French revolutionaries was a group that used to meet at the City of London Tavern in Bishopsgate. It was called the London Revolutionary Society. And this was a society that was expressly meant to celebrate the Glorious Revolution. Its real purpose was to create revolution in the present day. It was supposed to be sort of a commemorative thing for the Glorious Revolution, but then it actually became a front for fomenting revolution in France. And there's an American scholar named Micah Alpaugh, whom I cite extensively in my book, who has written about the extraordinary impact of this London Revolution Society and other similar societies in England, which were greatly admired by the French liberals and the French revolutionaries. They were all Anglophiles. They saw the American Revolution as a great inspiration. They saw the English tradition of liberty generally as a great inspiration. And so, in a sense, they were suckers for having British agents in the guise of English reformers and English revolutionaries approach them under the guise of being fellow radicals, but actually being operatives for British intelligence and sowing the seeds of what were essentially destructive ideologies that ended up with the establishment of the Jacobin clubs in France, which were founded under direct English supervision and in imitation of the English Jacobin clubs, and which were heavily infiltrated by these English Jacobins, as they were called, these Englishmen who were actually in many cases secret agents working for the crown. And so it was through this London Revolutionary Society that British intelligence infiltrated the French revolutionary movement and, according to Thomas Jefferson, deliberately moved it in a destructive and bloodthirsty direction.
Yeah, I'm not, my grasp of history is quite strong. When I go through, I mean, I do a lot of research into people's family trees as well, and I tend to learn the extra bits of history that I didn't know before during these processes. And I have to say, this all makes a lot of sense, because you can see we talk about America and the forming of those colonies, and that was kind of, again, propelled on by bloody Queen Mary's reign, and a lot of people who were like, I don't want to hang around here now. Not that I've seen that sort of murder happen. And even through Queen Elizabeth, there was obviously fear and etc. Britain was going to be taken at any time. And this is seriously a really interesting moment for secret societies and clubs, including the Merchant Adventurers Company and other clubs that would form into much bigger organizations. Listen, we're going to go for a quick break. You're listening to today's News Talk on TNT.
Sometimes life can be overwhelming, and suicide may seem like the only way to relieve the pain. Beyond Now is an evidence-based app created by Beyond Blue to help you cope when suicidal thoughts start to appear. You can use it to create an easy-to-follow plan that is personal to you and includes steps like know your warning signs so you can act early, make your environment safe by removing harmful items, activities you can do or people you can be with to distract yourself from suicidal thoughts, reminders of things that make you feel strong. Some of these steps might be tough to fill out, and that's okay. It can be helpful to make or share your safety plan with a trusted friend, family member, or mental health professional. You might feel like you're alone, but help is available. If you're worried you can't stay safe, use the red telephone icon to call your emergency contacts. Download the free Beyond Now app today to create your personal safety plan.
We all know what it's like to feel alone. But it just takes one new connection.
Want to get out of here?
To empower many.
This is unbelievable.
It doesn't take a superhero to bring forces together. We all have the power to reach out.
Let's go!
And help someone feel like they belong.
Pretty cool, huh?
We are stronger together.
Speaking on the issues that impact, Johnny Vedmore on today's News Talk TNT.
Hello, I'm here with Richard Poe, the author I love so much, who makes my job extremely easy and interesting because I just get to have a conversation in these times. I prepared a load of questions, but of course, the new questions spring into mind once I realize what Richard has discovered. You're brilliant at discovering things and walking along, and you've done so many books already. I'm really interested in the process of writing those books and how you go through it too, but I was talking yesterday about an infamous politician in the UK called Jacob Rees-Mogg. But you know a lot about his father, too. Can you tell us a little about William Rees-Mogg's effect on the world?
Well, I'll tell you, I first met William Rees-Mogg back in 1991. I interviewed him for Success magazine. He had a book out, him and his American writing partner. His name suddenly escapes me, but it was called The Great Reckoning, and he was predicting a total economic meltdown for the 90s. And at that time, I admired him and his co-author, and I gave a glowing review of their book, which almost got me fired. I had no idea what his connection was with any of this skullduggery. But later I found out that he was very close to George Soros. And in fact, when I later became involved with Newsmax, I was one of their earliest columnists, and Chris Ruddy asked me to do a cover story for Newsmax magazine. This was in 2004. Now, but by that time, I already knew that Rees-Mogg was very close to Soros, and I didn't mention that to Chris, but it was this other guy whose name again escapes me, who was pushing to do this story. I said, you know, are you sure? Now, I should explain. Rees-Mogg had turned up as the chairman of Newsmax media at that time. He was the chairman of the board. So I was saying, are you sure Rees-Mogg is okay with this? And the guy said, oh, yeah, don't worry. I'll handle him. And so long story short, I did a big expose of Soros, my first, came out in May 2004. They put me on the O'Reilly Factor. Media Matters for America went after me with knives and the whole bit. But then shortly after, we had a meeting in New York at a restaurant, and Rees-Mogg himself showed up. And it was there that Chris and this other guy were trying to apparently he didn't know that Newsmax had done this cover story basically exposing George Soros, and he wasn't very pleased. So I was sitting right there at the table, the culprit who had actually done it, and Chris and this other guy were trying to convince Rees-Mogg that, well, this is for the greater good, you know, Soros has taken a turn toward the dark side. They were saying all kinds of things, but Rees-Mogg didn't buy it. He didn't go for it. And I was informed shortly after there would be no more writing about Soros. And there wasn't. So that's sort of how I learned about Rees-Mogg, partly through things that I read and partly through my own experience. And the fact is, as I more recently wrote, just two, 3 years ago, I wrote an article called How the British Invented George Soros. And what I learned and what I showed is that the Soros that most of us know through the media is a construct. He's kind of a myth or a legend. And the person who created this legend and first put forth this legend to the world was William Rees-Mogg through the Times of London, of which he was a noteworthy columnist at that time in the early 90s. He had previously been editor of the Times for about 15 years, I think. Then he stepped down from that, but he was still a columnist, extremely influential. And the thing about Rees-Mogg, and again, this is the elder Rees-Mogg, William, I call him a bridge between worlds. And I think he really was that in many respects, because he was a very close personal friend of the British royal family. And he was also a very close personal friend with Jacob Rothschild, and very much involved in what we might call the grubby world of the City of London and the global investment that was going on there, and in Hong Kong he had some interests. So he was kind of a bridge between those worlds, and he was just the sort of person to act as a handler and kind of a publicist for someone like George Soros, who I contend was created by the British establishment to be a kind of figurehead, a sort of mouthpiece, who could talk to the press, who could take the blame for all kinds of operations, psychological operations, economic warfare operations, tanking national currencies, things that the British were actually doing, but that we were led to believe that somehow George Soros himself personally was doing, as if he were some kind of James Bond villain with with superhuman powers. And this picture of George Soros was expressly created and presented to us through the columns of Lord William Rees-Mogg in the Times. And then moreover, when Soros supposedly broke the Bank of England in what was supposedly a hostile outside attack, Rees-Mogg immediately sprang to his defense and said, no, he's a hero. He saved Britain, because by devaluing the pound, he disqualified Britain from entering the Eurozone, which was just getting started at the time. And Rees-Mogg said very plainly, this was the greatest thing that ever could have happened. Soros did for us what our own government didn't do. He saved us from the European Union. And in fact, there should be a statue erected of him in front of the Treasury, he said. And others have said he should have gotten a knighthood.
Yep. And Penelope Pitstop Ghost in the chat says, all actors on show for the masses. And when you were saying there, you know, they created him into this kind of Bond villain that would suit their agenda of being, you know, the face of all of these different agendas that are going on behind the scene that lots of people, of course, are involved in. That's the same sort of thing that you see, of course, with Klaus Schwab and the CIA kind of lifting Klaus Schwab and the CFR lifting Klaus Schwab to be this Bond villain on the mountainside at Davos, who's going to incorporate the same sort of structures, policies, things that are unpopular into everyday society. Now, if William Rees-Mogg is George Soros's handler, then do you think Jacob Rees-Mogg, William's son, who's extremely prominent in UK right-wing politics and is at the moment currently trying to reform the Conservative Party and lean it more to the right as Labour shifts, right? Do you think that he would have taken his father's place and gone into intelligence services as well?
I would assume that that's the case. I can't give you any evidence of it, other than the fact that he is his father's son and the inheritor not only of his father's name, but of his financial empire. And again, his father was a close friend and business partner of Jacob Rothschild. And when I suggest that he must be very wealthy, a lot of times British people, they say, oh, that no, he's just barely middle class. He doesn't have that much money. But I don't believe that. I mean, how can you be business partners with Jacob Rothschild for decades and not have much money? How does that work? So I don't know. There's just a lot of untruthfulness hovering about the whole situation. But the thing is, what I noticed that caught my attention is a few years ago, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, Jacob Rees-Mogg made some remark about Soros, and then everyone started attacking the British press, and politicians started attacking him, calling him an anti-Semite. And so all of a sudden he was a martyr. Oh, look, the Jews are going after him because he was brave enough to say something. And that whole thing seemed so fake to me. It just seemed like because his father created George Soros. It just seemed very fake.
There's a lot of that going on in politics at the moment. Richard Poe, my friend. Find him on X at Real Richard Poe. Visit his website, richardpoe.com. Invest in his books. You will learn something. He is a mind. Richard, thank you for coming on the Johnny Bedmore Show today.
Thank you.
Oh, it's all my pleasure. And thank you in the chat for you talking away. I do like it. Thanks for sticking with us on the Johnny Bedmore Show. Remember, go to tntradio.live and get in the chat. Ask a question or two if you want. I always appreciate your interactions. And we'll be right back after the headlines on today's News Talk TNT.